Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6, reading from verse 10 to verse 20. It says, "Finally, brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to the end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to." Let us turn to God in prayer. So we continue this series of studies on the Chinese culture, and along the way what we are going to do is to learn to apply biblical principles to the Chinese culture, and in that way, firstly, those of us from Chinese culture who may be new in the Christian faith will know how to live the Christian life in the Christian Chinese culture. Secondly, those who are older in the faith might need to be clearer on how the Bible's principles and teaching have to be applied to the Chinese culture, so that we can guide others who are new in the faith. And for those who are not from the Chinese culture, we know that we are from pagan backgrounds of various kinds in this part of the world, and so the method and the principles by which we go about living the Christian life in the Chinese culture may be adopted and then adapted to your own particular culture. So don't look upon this as a useless exercise or something that is irrelevant, but rather see that all our studies have relevance and value for us. So we come to this second study, the influence of Buddhism and Taoism. We have noted that the Chinese religion was carried out of China by the Chinese of the diaspora. This word diaspora is sometimes used as and in application to the scattered Chinese. It comes from the Bible. In 1st and 2nd Peter, the opening verse tells us of the Jews who were of the diaspora, the Jews who were scattered. So the Chinese have been regarded as the Jews of the East. So just like the Jews, they are very adept, very good at business, and they are very well organized. And because the Chinese are scattered all over the world, this word has been used upon them as well. And of course, the Chinese word for it is the Hua Chao Chinese. The Mandarin character are not quite needed for our study here, but I purposely checked them up in order to update my book, because after this series of studies, I intend to republish the book on Chinese culture. It has not been in print for a long time, and there have been requests over the years for the book. So only some old copies are being sold on Amazon, but the people who request for more copies are unable to find. So in the old days, I used the old style of spelling, the spelling style that is still used by some Westerners, but because today we use the pinyin romanized Chinese, and also in order to help people recognize it, for those who know Chinese, I decided to put the equivalent Chinese character as well, so that later on when I revise the book, it's easier, I don't have to search high and low, and too much work. Do it as we go along, instead of waiting till later, there's so much to be done, okay? So that's what roughly we are doing. So the Chinese religion was brought out of China by the overseas Chinese. And religion itself is largely suppressed in the cities of China, but it lingered on in the rural areas. I know because I visited, and we have relatives in China, and then we have visited the rural areas, and you see here and there signs that it is beginning to be more bold to show themselves. Then with the opening of China to the world in 1978, after Deng Xiaoping declared that China was going to have business and interaction with the rest of the world again, so the economy of China progressed so much, so that suddenly great wealth came to the nation, and because the nation is made up of such a big number of people, and a big number with a long culture that is unbroken, is one of the few ancient cultures that continues up to today unbroken, with 4,000 years of written history and with 2,000 years of oral history, making a total of 6,000 years of history. Then beyond that are the myths and legends, which are a bit difficult to record for sure. But look at the history of China. After the Ming Dynasty, when this Admiral Zheng He, or we say Cheng Ho here, Admiral Zheng He went around the world in big ships that were much, much bigger, probably 10 times bigger than the Portuguese ship that came to Malacca in the 17th century, that means 1600 something, in fact 16th century, towards the end of the 16th century, that means 1500 something. So early 1600, the Westerners began to come to this part of the world. They sailed around the world, they made discovery, they claimed that they discovered America. And their ship is so small compared to the Chinese ship. And the Chinese ship was designed in a certain way using principles based on the bamboo, you know, the bamboo plant. You see, it has sections, you see. So the ship is built in tiers with different compartments, so that when one part hit coral or rock and it leaks, it wouldn't affect other parts, you know. Smart, you see. And the ship is really easily, I would say, 10 times bigger than the Portuguese ship that came first to Malacca. And Columbus supposed to have founded America, when actually Zheng He's ship has already arrived there and left many Chinese who intermarry with the Red Indians. So, and Zheng He left his mark in this part of the world. Well, there were, each time, there were something like three groups of churches, two, three fleet of churches. Each fleet can consist of something like 3 to 5 ship, giant, huge ship, you know. So one would go perhaps east, one would go south, one would go west, see. Then they had experiments to carry out. They had to determine, in those days, latitude was easier to determine. So people of various cultures have plotted the latitudes of the earth, but the longitude was more difficult to plot. So they have to study the stars, and from their calculations, they know when there will be an eclipse and so on, in what, which part of the world. So they carried with them equipments and all the expertise, and they stationed themselves such that when an eclipse occur or any event in the skies happen, you see, then they noted down their findings and then come back, compare, and then they calculated, and that way they were able to plot the longitude, see, so that it's easier for them in the next travel. Yeah. So Zheng He himself came to Malacca, and then to various places like Java. He stopped in Java, he stopped in Borneo, and he also stopped in Myanmar. See? So there was exchange of culture. He would make gifts of things to the people, and then he would collect things of interest to him on the ship to bring back. But what happened is that while China was very advanced in one way, but it is also entangled with alchemy and astrology and superstition. See? So where do you draw the line between science and superstition? So it's hard to draw the line because they were on the forefront of research in many fields. So what happened is that the Emperor of China at that time, it has always been that the Emperor of China would regard himself as the son of the gods, you see? And so what happened is that lightning struck the palace, and one big part of the Forbidden City was burned up. So up to today, when you visit as a tourist, you see, the tourist guide will show you which part was burned down during that time, you see. So because it was burned down, the superstitious belief of the emperor was that the heavens was unhappy with China. And they were so prosperous, the Silk Road was bringing traders from everywhere, and they were sending out things, making silk, and silk was a hidden secret of China, and tea also was kept secret until the British and others went to smuggle out tea to plant in Sri Lanka, known as Ceylon in those days, and so on. They say, so tea was, processed tea was sold to other countries, people were drinking tea, but it was all a commercial secret, you know. And then the rearing of silkworms and making silk, all this slowly people infiltrated, and spies were sent to steal the secret and so on. But in China, it was there for a long while, it's very advanced. And then, you know, the glazing of the China pottery, you know, and the typical blue color, you see, they source the mineral from Turkey as far as Iran and Persia, and then they send by the Silk Road back to China, and then they process and then produce the coloring necessary to produce those glazed earthenware, which became well known all over the world. People collect items, and today, if you have the Ming Dynasty porcelain, it is very, very expensive. Yeah. So this is a little bit of the background, which you don't. It's hard to put down. You know, it's there is too much material, and we don't want to allow details to cloud the main flow of the thought in a book. But in a study like this, I can explain a little bit of the background. Okay. So what happened is, because of that lightning strike and the fire that raged in the Forbidden City, and the emperor, due to superstition and also, well, there was internal problems at that time, so he thought that heavens was unhappy with China. So what happened is he stopped all this foreign exploration. And in the third and last expedition of Admiral Zheng He, he returned to China instead of being welcomed like before, you know, by bringing all the foreign goods and unusual animals and creatures to China, you see. He was demoted, and then he was kept aside, you see, in cold storage. And all the ship was burned, and all the written records of that his travels was all burned, you know. Such a pity. Hey, you know. And how much other literature was burned away. So China clamped down and become isolated. And it remained isolated for 300 years, you see. Then after the 300 years, the Western powers now began to go to China, you know, and try to pry open China. And then they managed to take certain parts and make it their settlements. So Hong Kong is well known to us for, in recent years only, Hong Kong was returned by the British. They signed a treaty, and treaty is supposed to be between equals, but of course the Chinese government was bullied into signing to give to the British 100 years Hong Kong. Imagine got such thing. Macau was returned a few years earlier by the Portuguese. Say, but you must remember those are not the only two places. In Guangzhou area, there was concession of the Western people in Shanghai, and Shanghai was carved up between the British and the French and the Germans, you see, and the Americans, you see. Then the Germans were in the Qingdao area, you know, in Shantung province. You know. So up to today, if you visit Qingdao, you see the building, it is Western buildings, but somehow it's quite different from the British ones. You see, you look carefully, generally it's these Western buildings, but if you have been to UK, and then you will notice this building is slightly different from the West, the UK ones. Then when you listen to the people, or you have done some reading up, you know, if the Germans were there, this is German style building. So that roughly was the background. Okay. And what happened is that 300 years of isolation, then 100 years of being occupied by, in various parts of the coastal areas, by Western powers, you see, until finally Dr. Sun Yat-sen, Western trained doctor, led a revolution to overthrow the decadent Qing dynasty. So it was decaying from within, and the empress at that time was really, not treating the whole country like his own small family, and not using proper administrative principles to rule the country, so ignorant of a lot of things. And so what happened is, as each part of China was taken over by Western powers, the decay set in. So Sun Yat-sen trained in the West, but he was a patriot, so he quietly organized resistance to overthrow the Qing government. So he even had centers, he has various headquarters in different parts of the world, so that he could organize the overseas Chinese to lend support, and then he could travel, and there's a system of codes and signals had to be arranged so that he's not tracked and taken down too quickly. So he had a headquarters in Singapore, and then when things got too hot, he started a headquarters in Penang. And up to today, if you go to Penang, you can see the house he used as his headquarters there preserved. Okay. He had one in Tokyo. So with time, he succeeded to found the Republic of China, which is not to be confused with the People's Republic of China. So the Republic of China was founded. Then after that, after him, there was trouble. Japan has already attacked Manchuria, which is the northeast of China. Then Japan was finding an excuse to come down to attack Beijing. And remember, there's that well-known bridge today. If you go as a tourist there, the tourist guide will tell you, bring you to this bridge. This is where the Japanese waited on one side, the Chinese soldiers on the other side, each looking at one another and see who will start the war first, you see. And then the Japanese, by some trick, caused the Chinese to react, and then in that way they give the excuse to start attacking China. So the war against the Japanese began in full, and the communists and the nationalists united in order to fight their common enemy. So in due time, what happened is that when the Japanese was contained to some degree, the communists and the nationalists fought one another, and the nationalists lost the war and fled to Taiwan. Taiwan was, of course, part of China. So it remained today the situation like this. Taiwan trying to claim independence, but China refusing, saying that it's part of China. So roughly, that is the situation. What happened is, in the 300 years of isolation, Chinese culture was spread to every part of the world. So today, in recent years, these people in this part was trying to claim the sepak takraw, the rattan ball, the kick about, the rattan ball. They claim that it originated from this part of the world. But as the research was done, they discovered it was brought during the days of Zheng He. Yeah? So it was actually played in China, and that the chapte, the feather with the base for kicking. That was also played long ago in China. But because of the clampdown, the emperor made the order that from now on these games are not to be played, because it led people astray, and the palace officials, especially the palace ladies, were too caught up with the games instead of doing their job. But this will all spread around. Then in India and Sri Lanka, you see the special type of fishing net, triangular in shape, and then you use the leg to help you cast the net. That is also from China, you see. So in some parts of China today, you see that it's an ancient practice that. So many things was spread all over. Of course, China gained from elsewhere as well, but all this was the cut-off, that there was this period of 300 years of silence, you see, because China isolated itself. Then after 100 years of being occupied by Western powers, then finally it opens up. So with such a long period of time, you discover that the communist government, of course, tried to eradicate all religion, believing that it is not scientific, it is not good, people shouldn't be following superstition. See? But now they are discovering that while they advance economically and try to catch up in the science and technology, what happened is they discover an inner void. The spiritual part is lacking. So there is an attempt to recover Confucius' teaching, not recovering Confucianism as a religion, but rather to recover Confucius' values, in the hope that that will somehow fill in the void. Otherwise, people are just very mechanical, going about doing their work and treating things, everything as a business. Even human relationship is treated as a business. There's no morality, no ethical values. So they found that they are beginning to realize that this is dangerous. Now, human beings cannot have an empty inner self. There must be a moral compass in us. There must be morality and ethics. So currently, Confucius' values are being recovered, and along the way, Buddhism, which has been there for a long time, on and off, certain emperors persecuted the Buddhists and certain other emperors supported the Buddhists. But Buddhism has expanded in China, and of course with Taiwan being quite a center of Buddhism as well, it also has an effect on all this recovery of religion. But Christianity and Islam are regarded as Western religions, although it had gone to China very early. In 7th century, the Nestorians were known to have brought the Christian faith to Mongolia. One of the Mongolian queen was supposed to be a Christian. And along the way, relics of the Nestorian Christians are found in China when it was suppressed by one of the emperors. Then for a long while we didn't hear anything, and then in modern day missionaries went in. See? And the Roman Catholic missionary Matteo Ricci now was very clever man, and he spread the Roman Catholic faith there. Then after that, the Protestant missionaries followed suit. Okay? Then we know roughly the modern church history in China. What happened is between the 1960s to 1980, that 20-year period, see, after the Western missionaries were driven out, especially OMF. OMF suffered the most. About 52 missionaries were martyred, and local Chinese Christians were also killed during the Boxer Rebellion. Boxer, you mustn't think of Western boxing. Boxer means the martial arts people. They very organized people. They killed these missionaries, and OMF, known as China Inland Mission at that time, withdrew, and they decided to focus on the overseas Chinese and call themselves OMF. Today, they change again. They call themselves OMF International. Okay. So roughly, that's the story. And what happened is that when the Western missionaries withdrew, people thought that the Christian faith was dead. But actually, it wasn't. See, when China opened up, under Deng Xiaoping, at that time, 1978, it began to open up. People began to go, what to their amazement. See, the Chinese church had grown. And at that time, it was estimated at around 60 million Christians. And by now, it would be something between like 80 to 100 million Christians. And that's a huge number. But compared to the population, you must remember that is only about 10%, 9 to 10% of the population, because it's so huge, the population. And those who don't understand, they think that if there are really that many Christians, why don't they just go and march on the street and then overthrow the government? But that's Western thinking, you see. And that's not Christian thinking, you see. Why should Christians go on the march, and why should Christians overthrow the government? So people query, are there that many? If that many, they just go on the march and then the government will be toppled. But Christians don't think like that. The Bible never teaches topple governments. See? And we don't have to prove that there are 100 million of the Christians there in China. Why should we prove to the world by a show of force to have a revolution? So this is the situation. So in recent years, again, there's persecution. And again, the suppression, the fear more is more with the Islamic terrorism in the West. But the government cannot just focus on one group. So it has to be also the suppression of the Christians. So we see it happening now. So a number of Christian leaders have been taken in and not heard of after that. So our interest here is in the background leading to this study. If you missed last week's study, this is to provide you the background. And the Chinese religion, therefore, is found mainly among the overseas Chinese and the Chinese of Hong Kong and Taiwan, although they are part of China because of their isolation from history because of historical reasons. So you find it there. So today, if you go to Hong Kong, see under the overhead bridges, you see still little altars, burning candles to the god of the earth, and then people still practicing the leg, you know, take the sandals to beat your bad husband who is unfaithful and so on. You see, that type of superstitious beliefs and tied to folk religion, you still find it in Hong Kong on the streets. So you go past those small shop lots, you see, just like here in Malaysia, you know, little altars here and there, people offering food and burning candles or joysticks to the various deities. Okay? So we see it, yes, it is still very much alive, and don't be surprised today if you drive past the shop there, you see the shopkeeper come out, burn joysticks in front of you. So, see, are they putting on a show? Now, today, in this age, people still do that, man. But you look carefully, and they really believe what they are doing. So they come out really and burn your joysticks and put it there. Now go in there into the family altar and burn and then put there. They do it. Faithfully, they do it. And during festival times. So just a month or two ago, I was passing the shop lots in Atria there, you see, and I happen to know the shopkeeper, the tauke, the boss, and he was burning joss papers in front, hell notes, the joss papers. So I just wind down with the window and just ask him, what's the occasion why you should be crossing the paper? So that's the expression, crossing the paper. You don't say burning. Burning is okay. That's the plain way of saying it. But the term in their language or in our culture is to 过子, that is burn in order to pass over to the next world. So I just asked him, what's the occasion? Why are you passing over the paper? He said, 15 ma, the 15th month, 15th day of the month, it's a goma. Faithfully they do it. First day, 15th day of the month, they'll do it. So all in all, what I'm trying to say is the folk religion, the heart of the overseas Chinese, many are still entrapped in this. They are very faithful in their religion. Okay? And how do we understand it? And in our previous study, we say there are three main influences: Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. We have looked at Confucianism, which contributed to the moral, intellectual aspect of the Chinese religion, which leads to ancestral worship. Although Confucius himself did not teach people to worship the dead, but the concept of veneration of your elders, bowing down to them, serving them tea, and so on, it gets carried over to worshipping them when they are dead. Then Taoism has given to it its mystical content. Buddhism has contributed the philosophical, metaphysical content. And of course, Buddhism was not did not originate in China. It originated in India, but it spread to China in the first century AD. Okay? So we come to the influence of Buddhism and then the influence of Taoism. So we can only give very bare outlines so that you get an idea. Yeah? So Buddhism is as a religion captured the Chinese mind to a much greater extent than is commonly recognized. It is complementary to Confucianism. Confucianism has not much to say about life after death, nor about the spiritual realm. His concern is with peace in the country, unity, and beginning with the family, and if there's unity of the family, then the country will be united, and so on. So it has not much to say about the spiritual realm. With Buddhism coming in, it sort of complements what it lacks, what Confucianism lacks. Confucianism is more concerned with the practicality of living in this world, but having nothing to say about life after death. So Buddhism has something to say. Buddhism teaches reincarnation, the belief that the soul lives on in another form, as another person or another creature, an animal. Yeah. So if you do good in this life, you will be born to a higher life next, and higher and higher. But if you do bad, you're a wicked person, you might be born lower down the hierarchy. So you become a monkey next, or become a cockroach next. You see? So the cycles of rebirth of the soul into animals or men, reincarnation continues according to the law of karma, and ends only when enlightenment or nirvana is reached through meditation and abstention from worldly desires. There are Chinese equivalent terms to all this, see? And some of them are direct translations, some are transiterations. Yeah? But what happened is, after Buddhism went to China, it very quickly took on a local form. And today there are at least four main schools of the Mahayana Buddhism. Generally we say Buddhism, Mahayana or Theravada. See? So in China and East Asia, including Korea and Japan, the Mahayana form of Buddhism is the more dominant one. But in China itself, Mahayana Buddhism is subdivided into at least four main schools. You say, how do you know all this? You can check up, of course, but remember this was written before the internet came in, see? And remember, I'm from such a background, and I actually have a correspondence course in Buddhism for 2 years from the Buddhist Missionary Society in Kuala Lumpur. And because of that, I had to do some reading along the way, you know, searching out the public library and going downtown to search for all the books in Buddhism and read through. Okay? So that is roughly the background. So, yeah, you can go very far, very deep, but the point is, at the end of the day, God willing, after the next study on a little bit of Chinese philosophy, we have to conclude that you can delve into any area of knowledge very deeply, and there will be much to learn and much to study. But the point is, you see, don't overlook the fact that you must see things in the perspective of life and the perspective of truth. And when you know the Bible, you know the Lord Jesus Christ, you see things in this perspective, you see. You discover that in Buddhism or in Islam, in Hinduism or whatever else, you know, even in science, you can go in and delve so much and build up a lot of literature, write books and so on. See, you become the expert with so much knowledge in that area. But if you get out of perspective, you fail to see life as a whole, and you may be focusing on something that whose foundation is shaky. See? And the thing is, because we have come to have life through faith in Jesus Christ, we want to help people to see that while there is a legitimate place to engage in certain studies in a deeper way, but don't overlook the fact that you must see life in this proper perspective. And we are advocating that the Bible provides us the correct worldview, and then to come to know God, our Creator. Then you see all these branches of knowledge in this right perspective. Failing which, you get so carried away, you become such an expert in that area of knowledge, but it's on shaky ground. You see, it's a superstructure whose foundation is weak. So when the time comes for it to fall, it will be a big crash. You see? Now I wonder if that picture, that illustration, helps you to capture what I'm trying to convey across. That, you see, there's a legitimate place for deeper studies in various areas of life, but be very careful. Some areas are not worthwhile pursuing to give your life to, say, without the firm basis of the truth of Scripture. Okay. Then the second point, the average Chinese is pragmatic and does not concern himself with the details of the law of karma. Nirvana is vaguely associated with the heaven of Taoism, and failure to attain Nirvana with hell. And while living, he tries to live a virtuous life. When there is a death, he mourns and obediently carries out the necessary rituals. Paper models of money, a house, a car, servants are burnt so that the soul of the deceased may have access to these items. Yeah. And Buddhism as a philosophy exerted a great scholastic influence on the Chinese mind and inspired many Chinese writings. One example is the Chinese classic Journey to the West, Si Yu Ji, written by Wu Zhenren during the Ming Dynasty. It contains stories of the Goddess of Mercy, Guan Yin, then the Monkey King, Sun Wukong, there's repetition, and then the monk, the monk who traveled to the West, Tan Zhen, and then the big man, Zhu Ba Jie, and then suddenly, Sa Wu Jin. Then there is the Feng Shen Bang is translated variously as canonization or investiture of the gods, you see, written by this Shi Zonglin during the Ming Dynasty. Here, this is basically a romanticized story of the fall of King Zhou of the Shang Dynasty. When it was the Shang Dynasty, it's in B.C. Millennium, in the Shang Dynasty, all the way to the early period of the founding of China. It contains stories of Ne Zha. Now, in Hokkien we say La Zha, Ne Zha. And Ji Gong is a monk who broke. Ne Zha is the one who travels around on rings of fire, he's basically a messenger god, you see. And then there is Ji Gong. Ji Gong is supposed to be a Buddhist monk, but he is an unorthodox Buddhist monk who ate meat and drank wine. And then he got into a lot of trouble, but because his supernatural power was great, so he managed to help a lot of people. You see? And then the dragon god of the sea, he features in the story. Then Ne Zha is supposed to have renounced his family by cutting out the flesh from his own body to return it to his parents. Yeah. So his existence came from the parents. So he always got in trouble with his parents, and he wanted to do his own things. He had a shifu, a martial arts teacher. Along the way, what happened is he returned his body to the parents by cutting out his flesh to return to the parents. Of course, he died. You see? But his martial arts teacher, who is also with divine power of some kind, he made new flesh for him, for this Ne Zha, using lotus leaves. So roughly there's this story. And what happened is that along the way, the intertwine is the philosophy which we will look at next study, God willing, the yin yang principle, the patkwa, and this how transformation takes place from Wu Qi to Tai Chi and so on. You see, that we will have a look at a little just to get an appreciation of Chinese philosophy. But here we just want to take note that legendary figures mixed with mythical figures, figures that are invented by the mind, combined with the Chinese mythical and philosophical beliefs, you have this hodgepodge of things. So these are just examples of the books that have exerted such influence upon the Chinese mind. And many Chinese, they quote sayings and they behave in a certain ways without thinking where their action or their thought came from. But actually you can trace it to the influence of these classics which mold the Chinese society so much. So Si Yu Qi Feng Sheng Bang. Then, of course, the legends of San Kuo Yan Yi, and see a few others. You see, these are some of the classics that affect the Chinese mind a lot. So the typical Asao next door, you know, and when somebody dies, if you have a interaction with her, you see, and then she will be saying, you know, perhaps you see, the soul of the deceased is on its journey, you know. Soon you arrive at a destination. Okay? Then he has to pass through the bridge. Then he has to pay certain taxes, you say, to pass through. That's why on certain day, perhaps the 7th day, they have to burn certain things. The 40th day, they have to burn certain things. On the 100th day, they have to burn certain things, and of course offer up food as well, so that the deceased have things to hand out to the various the gates, the guan. Every gate he has to go through, you know, in his journey to his final resting place. So where did all this come from? You see, actually it's all from all these classics. You see. Then note that the deities worshipped by the Chinese are really legendary or mythical figures. Legendary means originally there were such historical persons. Last week we mentioned Quan Yi, for example, generally known as Quan Kong. Kong is, means grandpa, Kong. So Quan Kong is the title for someone who is old and venerated, you see. So Quan Kong was a general in his time, a very good fighter, you see. And with bearded guy, powerful carrier, horse-cutting knife, you know, the horse-cutting Quan Tao. Quan Tao means with a long handle with a curved sword at the end. Those were used for slicing down horses, people who were soldiers riding on horses, slice their legs or cut from the ground at the rider, you see, because it's long. But because it's heavy, it requires skill and also strength. So this man, Quan Yi, happened to be a powerful man. You know, he has the height, he has the strength, and he also has the skill. Because heavy weapons, you see, you can't want to swing. You left yourself open. A person with a light weapon will come in and poke at you. So you see, one swing, you are leaving yourself open. You can't wait until you pull up again, and then another poke comes in. So heavy weapon and light weapon, the fighting methods are different. Long weapons and short weapons, the fighting methods are different. See? So long and heavy weapons like the Quan Tao, for example, you slice, you mustn't stop. You know, you swing, you just use your body and the next, you save time and save the move, see? Whereas the short weapon, you must move near, see? Then light weapons, you must deflect, see? Heavy weapons like the Quan Tao, you can use brute force. So Quan Yi was known to be one who used a well-known Quan Tao. And because he was a legendary figure, there was such a person, there's no doubt that there was really such a person, you see, in history. But if the story of his exploits passed down and then stories are written and romanticized, and sometimes it's hard to tell which part is real, which part is not real. You know? So the government of China has have ordered the scholars there to do research and study, and they try to separate what is myth and what is legend and what are true. So along the way they try to work out certain things, and then they will come to the authoritative version. So along the way in history, different versions have been produced. They come to through such studies to declare which version was authoritative. Okay, you can check that up yourself. No? But our purpose is just to give an appreciation that there is such thing as legends and myths and history all mixed together. Legends are historical figures that are romanticized. Myths are invented. Yeah? There's no such thing as monkey king, a pig man, for example. A man might look quite like a pig, or a person may behave quite like a monkey, but it's different from saying that he's actually a monkey who somehow become half man. So there's no such thing. Huh? Then you see, then it enters into the thinking and the conversation of the Chinese in the Chinese culture. So if you're not in the culture, then sometimes you wonder why the Chinese are laughing away or they are smiling. You see, so for example, you see, if we are referring to the politics and what the politicians are up to, we say, wow, this man, it's like the Monkey King with his 72 abilities to change. You see, because in the novels, the Monkey King can change into 72 things. He can change himself into a feather, he can change himself into an ant. There are 72. So we say, wow, you know, this man, I don't want to mention name, this man, he can, with all his 72 changes. So those who understand, you know, they will be smiling. Or you just mention somebody, you know, we say, Cao Cao arrived already. So, Cao Cao arrived already. So if you know the background, you see, you just mention the name and that person happened to arrive. So it's all based on the stories of those days. Okay? So we come to the influence of Taoism. Lao Tzu is often claimed to be the founder of Taoism, and he is claimed to be the author of the Tao Te Ching. Tao Te Ching is translated as classic of the way of integrity. Tao Te, Te. Now my grandson in Boston is Te. So Te, Wu Te. This is Tao Te Ching, the classics of the way of integrity. But it must be remembered, before Lao Tzu's time, there was already a philosophical cosmology which existed in its elementary form. And earlier than that, there was this Fuxi who was supposed to have lived in the 29th century BC. BC, not AD. And he was supposed to have invented a Pakua, or 8 trigrams for divination. So God willing, in the next study, if we delve into a little bit of the Chinese philosophy, we'll come across this. Basically, the yin-yang principle is represented by lines. The yang is represented by a solid line. The yin principle is represented by a broken line. See? So it's like yes, no, male, female, light and darkness. See? So yang is strong, bright, hot, angry. Say yin is cold, feminine, soft. See? So by combinations, you can have four combinations. See, one at the top, broken at the bottom, terbalik, and then by combining the two, then combining two sets, three sets, you have different combinations, up to 64 combinations. Then, and it stops at 64. From there, it's sufficient to predict the things that happen, to label the things that happen around us. Then combined with the changes, when light comes, darkness will withdraw. When darkness comes, light will withdraw. So it's sort of a gradual process. See, it's not abrupt. So it's represented by the two moving fish, black and white, the Tai Chi diagram. Then arranged around it is the Pakua, the different changes possible by combining yin and yang. See? So more of this will be said in the next study, God willing, but for the moment, just take note that this was already in its elementary form from early days. And Fuxi is regarded as a mythical, a divine ruler with the body of a snake who gave humanity the skills of animal husbandry, taking care, rearing animals, domesticate animals, fishing with nets, hunting with iron weapons. The Tao Te Ching must be not be confused with another book. The I Ching. I Ching is another ancient classic of Taoism. The I Ching is a book of divination which applies the yin-yang principles and the Bakwa concept to life. Okay? Feng Shui and so on all flows out from all this. Okay? Then Taoism, like Confucianism, aimed at the attainment of peace and contentment in an ordered society. Confucius approached the objective from the upper ruling class of scholars, while Lao Tzu approached it from below, from the common man upwards. Okay? During the Han Dynasty, Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism were merged into a common philosophy that continues to have a considerable influence upon the overseas Chinese and the Chinese in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Then Taoism as a religion developed occultism, which includes mediumship, astrology, fortune telling, and communication with the dead. It lends to the Chinese religion a mystical aura in which superstitious beliefs developed and thrive. The idea that there are ghosts around, there are fairies flying about. Generally, fairies are treated as good. Ghosts are treated as malicious or bad. Okay, and it all is intertwined into Chinese culture. So I give you some examples in the last study. Those who want to get rich quick, so they go and buy a lottery, either four-digit lottery or three-digit lottery. So to buy the lottery, you have to get the numbers. Okay? So they will go to the altar or then get it from their ancestors. Okay? Or they go to the grave of the ancestor and then they would worship and then try to get numbers from there. Okay? And various scary type of practice would be carried out. And one example is this. They go to the cemetery at night. See? Then they will burn joss sticks or candles and then pray there. Yeah? Say to the deceased person, some polite words, like to our senior who has gone away, you know, here are your juniors who come to pay you respects, see, and we want to request for you to bless us with prosperity and so on, you see. And what happened is that there is a basket, you know, there's bamboo basket, the thin bamboo basket used for, you know, when you want to sift away dirt from your, say, let us say onion or garlic, you rub, and the peelings come out. Then you let the wind blow. In the old days, we use the natural wind to blow, or use a mouth. Today, you just put on your fan, standing fan there, you see, and then you flip. So the heavy onion would stay in the sieve, the basket. See, the light skin will be blown away to one corner, one side, you see. Then later, you sweep away the dirt, you see. They use that awe, see. And then they put the yellow strips of paper, you know, for protection that time, you know. And then they go to seek the spirit, and then the bamboo stick appears into the mound behind the gravestone, you see. It's supposed to lead up the spirit, you see. And then they, as they worship, you know, they try to get numbers by casting whatever they use to determine the number, you see. So that is what the sort of things they got into. So another example was, I told you about the black magic woman. Behind our house was an old lady who always walked like, you know, why? She walked like that because her legs were bound. And at night when she took it off to wash, you know, wow, the cloth was so long, we were so amazed, you know. One piece of cloth to tie the feet, see. So you know, pig tying was practiced in the old days, and the Chinese ladies, and so they thought that Chinese, their small feet would be nice, that when they walk, you know, dainty, they claim it's dainty, very attractive, you see. But this person was involved with this, what do you call that, mediumship and things like that, you know. So what happened is, the daughter-in-law's father-in-law, that means the daughter, this black magic woman's son-in-law's father passed away. See? So they want to call up the spirit to find out how he is. So that was what happened, you see. This person, this old black magic woman went into a trance, you see. Then when she was in a trance, she spoke in a male's voice, you know. And crying away, you know, and see. And in a sing-song, in sing-song words, say to those around, see, that you must, you all fail to take care of me, and this and that, my house is leaking, and so on. So many things were said. Then they asked him question about, what about so-and-so, the deceased relative, what and so-and-so, the other deceased relative, have you met them, and so on, you see. So it's like the life after death. They are meeting together, so they're asking about how they are and so on. See? Then after that, when everything was over, the person was herself again. She spoke with a normal voice again, and she was sweating away. People gave her power, she wiped away. Then she asked, so how was it? Huh? Did you manage to meet him and talk to him? See? She didn't know what she said. You know? She was in a trance and speaking in a different voice. Huh? Then they interpreted that the house leaking, they was asking, as a young boy, I remember listening to them so astounded, listening to them, what they were saying. They say, one of them concluded that the tomb there must be a crack, you see. So we must go and repair the tomb. He's complaining that the house is leaking. See? So you see, that type of practice is around, huh? So these are little examples here and there to say that, to show to you that it's very much intertwined in Chinese culture, and often people practice those things or say certain things, or their behavior, they behave in a certain way, they don't realize that there's this culture that has influenced them. And culture in itself is not necessarily wrong, it makes us who we are, but what we want to take note of is that the strong religious element there must be distinguished from what is not non-religious, and that in the future study in this series we will try to apply that in practical Christian living. So we take note that Taoism gives to it the occult part, the Taoist monk and with a fu, you know, the yellow strip of paper where you burnt. If you consult a medium, so my son is sick, and then he has not been sleeping well, and next week is his exam, so can you help him? So no, right, yellow strip of paper with red ink. So this one you bring home, you burn in front of the house to the God of Heaven, and this one you burnt over a bowl of water, so you strike a match and burn it, burn, and then drop the ashes into the bowl of water, then ask your son to drink, you see. Like that. So it's supposed to give him good health and protection. Yeah. So they believe that this helps. Yeah. So before I went to UK, I had 3 pieces of yellow paper and 1 cloth one, which was so precious because cloth don't tear easily, folded into a triangle, you see, in my wallet, you see. Then when I became a Christian, I remember, hey, in my suitcase, the empty suitcase on top of the table of the cupboard, I say, hey, I still have those things. It's not right, like, keep those. So I have to take them down, see, to destroy, see. So a little bit pang of emotion here, you know. Hey, this given by my parents before I left, see. But no, thrown away. Then the paper, the cloth one is more difficult. Hey, I have still one precious cloth full there, you know. Go and take it out and tore into pieces as well, see. So that happened, see. So this is sort of background we are from, see, and up to today we are seeing this, and I mentioned the shopkeeper across the road just burning job paper, you see. It's, we thought, you know, 30, 40 years, and now, I mean, the 60s, I thought, you know, people would have outlived that. But it's still there, see. And some of my brothers are still burning job sticks every day, you know. And we thought he's just putting on a show. But they, even when nobody's around, they still do it. That means there's something there, something that captures them, that makes them believe in it, you see. They continue to do it, see. So we must understand the grip upon of the Chinese religion upon the people, see. Then in occult practices, mediums are seen to be capable of doing unusual things, including revealing secrets, curing diseases, walking on burning embers, etc. Spirits are classified into good and bad ones. And seen from the Christian perspective, what is not often recognized is that the spirits are all accomplices of the devil, whether they pose as good or wicked ones. Remember, we are in a Bible study, we are applying the Bible to our culture. How we are not here to criticize or attack people. Yeah? So don't go out and tell your unbelieving relatives saying that, you know, your good spirits are all devil and so on. You see, you don't go and tell them unwisely like that. But for yourself, if you have become a Christian, you want to know, you must know whether they pose as good spirits or bad spirits. They are actually the agents of Satan. Yeah? They cannot possibly be God's good angels, you see, because God's good angels wouldn't be serving a pagan religion like that, you see. And then remember, just as Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who founded Buddhism, he was only a man. He may be a good man, he may be a prince who cared for the suffering, but he's only a man. See, he's not God. See, Lao Tzu is a so clever man, you see. In his days, he could come up with principles that are summarizing things into just a few poems, imagine. Well, his book just contains something like, you know, 30 poems, short poems, you see. But oh, you just take some one or two examples, you see, this man is really a super intellect. He has observed things, and he has analyzed things, and then he has summarized things, and then here he is putting into just a few lines, principles. And you're so amazed at the intellect of this man. He may be such a clever man, but however clever he may be as a philosopher, remember, he's still a man, see? And the superstitious beliefs of the Chinese people actually flows from the imagination of man, see? And the devil easily takes advantage of the atmosphere of mysticism to hold captive the minds of the people, see? We in the West, we use the word hypnotized, yeah? But in the East, we use the word me. You just follow, you don't think, but don't stop to think, is it right, is it wrong? You just do it, you just take it as true. You just do it, see? It has been done for centuries, and you just do it. Then we come to the final section, unmasking the Chinese religion. So after noting this in the light of scripture, we will have to take note that the Chinese religion is nothing more than theistic humanism. Humanism is a system of thought or teaching that concerns itself not with divine but with human interests. But when you add in ideas of the deities and gods, then it's theistic humanism. It's still centered around man. Man is the center of the greatest interest. And in theistic humanism, the gods are given attributes conjured up by the human mind. The two main motives that make the Chinese pray to the various gods are for the gods: one, to give him material prosperity, and second, to protect him and his family from calamities. These are the two things that bottom line they ask for. Just give me prosperity, give me freedom from calamities. Ping an, bu shu. So you are at peace, at no tragedy comes to you. Then you are prosperous. You don't have to be super rich, but you are generally prosperous. You are able to eat well. Then therefore you have good health. See, yeah, longer life. See, so you see the three gods, you know, the health, life, long life, and wealth. See, they are often put together. You know, See? So these three deities. So summarize, they just ask for two things. In principle, they say, just give us sufficient. We don't want to be in want. Then secondly, no tragedy comes to us. That's all that we want. See? And all religions to them leads to the same end, which is the good of mankind. Yeah? Typical of other humanistic philosophy. Then we end by noting that in Chinese culture, the 变脸, yeah, 变脸, changing a face. The face changes. Normally four, you see, red, green, blue, black, generally. You notice? I show you after a video clip if you want. See, 变脸. It used to be part of the show of the Sichuan opera. In China, there are different style of opera. Again, you see, we get sidetracked, but it's interesting information. Many don't realize. See, the Cao Zhou and Fu Chen opera is one kind. The Ye type, the Cantonese type is one type. The Beijing type is another type, you see. Then the Shanghainese type is another type, you see. Then the Sichuan, the Guizhou, different. You know, each has its own peculiarities, its own distinctives. Generally, for an outsider, you don't know what they are saying, and then you think that their music are the same, but actually, for those who are in the culture, you can detect the difference. Ah, that's Cantonese. Ah, that is Fujian or Cao Zhou. Ah, that is Beijing opera. You see, the tune is actually different, but it belongs to that genre, that broad category. It's not like pop music or not like country folk songs, but it tends to belong to that type of that style of music that belongs to the opera. And for the Sichuan opera, one of their acts was to change their mask very quickly, you see. There's music in the background along the way, then the person colorful dress, the face is red. Then after the lips are there, it becomes another color, and then another color. He turns around and I show you another color right in front of your eyes. You see it, you are amazed and you're scared, you know. Hey, how real it is. What's the hand next move? How he's so fast and so quick. How did he do that? It really takes you in. See? And we know this is acting. They have mastered the art. They have so well that the illusion is so real that they can change the face. And I use this to say the 变脸 entertainment is today in many cultural shows. It was a peculiarity of the Sichuan opera. But today, you go to Beijing or you go anywhere, if your tourist guide brings you to a show, normally they do, either bring you to, in the day they'll bring you to various factories and make you buy things, and then in the evening they'll bring you to relax a bit to watch a show. And the acrobatics and everything, including this changing of the faces show, will be there. It's quite common now everywhere, especially in Chinese cultural shows. Now, why do I mention this? I mention this because it reminds me so much of what the Bible tells us, that we are engaged in a spiritual warfare. And that we fail to see that although the Chinese believe in good spirits and bad spirits, they go to the good spirit to ask for help to ward off the bad spirits, you know, but actually, the same bosses behind them is the devil, Satan. See? And that's why I say changing faces. It's the same person. See? And in this closing section of this study, I want to say it's unmasking the Chinese religion. You see the three main strands of influence that makes it what it is, together with the writings of the people through history, the classics, then together it molds the character and the thinking and the way of life of the overseas Chinese especially. Okay, and of course it has its effect still, remnant in the mainland Chinese, like it or not. Although we outwardly, we often say outwardly we look the same, but our thinking is so different, because to them, many of them were brought up as one child, this generation, one child policy in each family. So one child, they were spoiled. Then they became rich so quickly, and then they have lost the soul as it is, you know, they have no religion. So everything is money, money, material, you know, they don't have a sense of ethics and morality. So there's a China student in this college across the road, in Subang College. What happened is he wanted to get the lecturer to give him the answers to the exams, before the exams. So he offered him money. And of course to the lecturer there's bribery. He want to bribe me to give you the answers beforehand. See? So he was reported and he was brought to the principal. So they form a committee to put the student on trial. The student was so innocent and argued. He said, it's a business deal. I offer you money, you don't want, you say no, it's okay. You see? So there's no sense of ethics of the right and wrong of it anymore. And you discover this keeps appearing here and there. See? But finally speaking, the culture is so long, you discover, dig deeper, the same way of thinking and same way of behavior is in all of us. See? So that's why in the end we must say that it's actually a form of theistic humanism, and the Chinese do need the gospel. They need to know the creator, without which we will continue to be in the grasp of this religion. See? So with that we come to the end of tonight's study. Are there questions or comments?